Okay, welcome. Thursday, 27th. And good. And try to get here about early, so I'm still late. But I started over here about 1:15, and I got talking to a bunch of people. But I finally got here. And I saw some emails from people. Has anybody uploaded the assignment? Has anybody tried it from Tuesday? Looked at it? Do you see it? Okay. So you were able to look at it, do your stuff, and upload it. Okay, we got one success. Now I have to see if I can actually see the assignment that you uploaded. So that's due on Tuesday, and we'll cover all the issues today or all the topics for that. So hopefully I don't expect it to be difficult. Just make sure you do it because we can't give you points if you don't hand it in or answer questions. So I assume that no one else has questions about the assignment. Should be able to grab it from Blackboard and upload the results, right? Any other questions about anything? Any questions about Wetamod or any of the slides or anything we talked about so far? probably don't want to talk about the football games and the Super Bowl. Well, I'm a Packers fan.
That's rough,
bud. I know. You know, I grew up in Northern Michigan, so it's the Packers or the Lions. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You know. You know.
I don't play.
My favorite thing is I think the Denver Broncos and the Packers should be in the Super Bowl every year. No. Sorry. I just lost all your respect, huh? So bonus question: when were the Packers and Broncos in the Super Bowl together last? Extra question. Okay, see if you can Google that. And so let's get on to some serious work with some legal aspects of weather modification. So applications, when you we want to do applied weather modification work. So basically we have laws, liability, and then a lot of times we are producing or hope to produce more water at the surface. So there's water rights issues. So particularly out west, this whole book's written about the water rights and the Colorado River and the use of that. So when they settle the west, to be able to use that area around and have people settle there, the water rights were a big issue. And there's been Supreme Court cases and treaties about the water rights and the fact that they overprescribed the Colorado River. They went and historically took the highest period of record and climatology a high period. And they said, that's how much water we have to divvy up. Well, that wasn't how much they had. So then it becomes a water rights issue. So who makes laws and rules? Not surprising me, basically legislatures in the United States makes laws regarding regulations, funding. Administrative agencies will typically apply or make regulations to implement the laws. They also issue licenses and permits and administer programs. And then the other ones are the ones when there's disagreements, you have cases, disputes, decisions. Courts will do that. That's what I alluded to the water rights issues in the Colorado River, particularly because it's between the states. You have federal court laws and that have to settle the disputes. So levels of laws, typically, I have mine with a pyramid here. You have international laws kind of on top with treaties, but then you have federal laws, state laws, and not too applicable to weather modification, municipal, regional, towns and cities. So basically in the weather modification, it states, and there's lots of variations in the state laws. Federal government usually has sometimes appropriations, studies for weather modification. They have reporting requirements, and internationally, there's the World Meteorological Organization. So there's a branch that deals with weather modification at the WMO. Regulatory agencies. So what's your Can someone tell me a regulatory agency that you might be familiar with?
FAA.
FAA. So FAA stands for? No, there you go. How would I not get that one from your, this audience, huh? So they regulate flights of aircraft so that we don't have one airplane trying to get in the same space as another airplane and causing potential issues, right? So the FAA does not regulate weather modification except in the case of having to have modifications to airplanes. But typically it's regulated at the state level with boards such as North Dakota, where there's a director of the board that runs that regulatory agency. And then there's staff members that work and carry out the more routine tasks. So typically, you know, regulations in the United States are at the state level. So then there becomes issues with interstate regulations. So what happens when rivers cross borders and you've done some crowd seeding? Permitting, you can have shared equipment. One project can share the other ones, water rights, agreement, and then liabilities. What about agreements? Think there's ever a case that one state would want to have some water rights or some weather modification agreement with another? So give me some examples. What might be a type of agreement that they have? Yeah, so what would be a good example out west of that where one state might want it to rain? So in the western United States, what's a big user that has a lot of population?
California.
And, you know, Colorado, Wyoming, they can carry out the weather modification work with the theory that it will melt in the mountains, flow down, get into the Colorado Basin, and be usable. So there is a case that California does pay. They call them the lower basin states in the West to supplement or contribute to some of the activities in the upper basin states. So it kind of makes sense. So that's an agreement that has been worked out between them. International obligations. So in atmospheric science, what's another international agreement that people use in, I guess, data sharing or something like that, where you have the atmosphere involved? What can you think about?
NOAA.
What will? Say it again.
NOAA.
That's NOAA, that's a federal agency. So they might, but what, that's a US agency, but what internationally type of cooperation would you think about when you think of the atmosphere a lot?
Possibly predicting hurricanes to the surrounding areas.
Okay, so predicting hurricanes. So what do you think you need to help predict where the hurricanes are gonna do and make landfall? What you have a model, a weather model, right? It's going to predict that, but what's very essential to them weather models?
Imaging.
So what does the imaging give you?
Real-time data about what's actually happening.
So the data, okay. So so what type of data would you have? Temperature, pressure, you know, where the lows are, how what the temperature is like in the atmosphere, what the winds are like. So we typically get that from balloons that fly. Okay, but also from airplanes now, right? A lot of the international flights have weather sensors on them. And one of the projects I involved was working with a weather sensor that is now on regional aircraft. So that data is very essential. So one of the things international is we share that data. Okay, so the US contributes what they have and other countries, like the US and Canada, you know, we have storms. And so their measurements and ours are very important. So that's it, the idea is we have international obligations to share data, give notice about the seed-in. We can consult how this affects another country. So for example, in Africa, when storms come across and you have smaller countries, you know, what are you doing in? The other countries might want to know. So typically the international can do some decisions, but they really don't have much authority to do anything. So, you know, you can go and do international courts and stuff, but they can't do anything themselves. And then a lot of times you have to prove liability. So you have international obligations to report a lot of times is the main thing. So state and the regulations. Common ways for weather modification is regulated, okay? Like a lot of activities. FAA is a regulatory, there's a lot of regulatory in terms of licensing and permitting. Okay, you're familiar with licensing, but give me an example. Okay, what about another license that might come from this audience? Yeah, there you go. Pirate's license. So permits are a little bit less on the aircraft side, but more on the weather modification. All of our programs have to be licensed or permitted. So there's a permitting process in North Dakota. Okay. And one of the reasons we don't have the ability to do crowd seeding in Minnesota, for example, is there's no way we can, you know, there's no infrastructure to apply for a permit. Okay. So a lot of times you have regulatory and permitting in the states. So the licensing is the authority to practice professionally. So in North Dakota, there's a licensing for weather modification activities. So if you're a company, you have to have a license to conduct professional practices of weather modification. And then there's a permitting process for each activity. So when they first started weather modification, like in North Dakota, they talk about these farmers that would buy like an airplane. Let's go up and see the crowds. Well, it didn't take long before they said, well, we should really have some licensing and permitting of these activities. So authority to operate, definitions, authority to practice. So here goes back to your license.
You enjoy this picture of the pirate's license. Number one.
So you need some professional qualifications. To meet this, we have standards. So I'm on, want to raise the qualifications, the criteria I've set is by organizations. So there's a standards committee on the American Association for Civil Engineers is where weather modification falls under. So they have standard documents about how to do different types of weather modification. And in them documents, they talk about training, education, or you can have experience. So when you have a license, you know, you typically you can be granted or denied that license. You have to apply. Also, organizations can have licenses or grant some status for procedure. So there's operational weather modifications. If you want to be in charge of a program, you contain some licensing, and then this, you know, from a organization, and then the states can require that type of licensing. And of course, it's typically renewed or not renewed. And then you can suspend temporary or revoke them licenses. So that's the kind of the stick. If you don't do right, we can, you know, suspend your license. And if you really don't change the practices, then they, you know, revoke that license. Typically, when you have permits, you know, you're asking for a permission again, and you can grant or deny that permit. You have an application process. A lot of times you have hearings that it can be typically public or some form of that. And then you can have the permit be provisional, and if you need some more information, you can renew that permit. You can have it every year that you have to renew the permanent process, and you cannot renew that. And permits modified, suspended. So sometimes you have criteria in your permanent process where if you're doing a weather modification and there's, you know, excessive flooding in the area, you may suspend your operations because of that unusual event. You don't want it, even if it's not really going to create a flood or something, you don't want to necessarily have even the perception or the state doesn't. That you're doing something that would contribute. So if I had people call me up and say, hey, we got these excessive rain, why are they doing crowd seeding and increase the amount of rain? And if there is really excessive amount of rain, they do suspend the programs just so that people aren't concerned about that. So in terms of weather modification, the only federal law is about reporting. You report the activities you have. When you do it, the contents, number of days, the purpose, number of hours that you've seeded, seeding agents. So in the North Dakota project, they have a report. They list all these things to keep track of them. Because it's a federal reporting requirement. And it's typically done at the annual level, to annually report. And then I think WMO has registration so you can track the number of projects around the world. And a lot of times they international projects start up and then they stop. And so to keep track of them, you have the forms. State reports, forms, data to have on that stuff. So it's a lot of requirements there. So if you do these things, the applications, a lot of times you're required to fill out all these daily reports, how much fertilizer you use, how much materials, so they can keep track of it and then report it. So it's not, you know, it's a requirement. It's not just to keep you busy. So, so the other aspect is if you do these, permanent processes, sometimes they require some assessment of the environmental impact. And they have federal requirements under certain conditions for environmental impact statements. And some states do. So environmental impact statements, when federal dollars are involved, seen and actually done, and when there's possible significant impact. So most of this, really no federal funding of water modification applications now. But these environmental impact statements take a long time and may kill a lot of projects if you have to do that. And I got my little diagram here that shows, you know, some of the things you have to do in terms of notice of intent, draft the statement, get comments on it, write a final one, and then publish it a lot of times.
What does it mean by seeding actually done?
I think you need to do the reports only if you're actually going to do the seeding in the area.
So these EIS are pretty common to happen?
Not for North Dakota stuff? I don't think North Dakota requires the actual environmental impacts.
Okay.
But I think they are required more for we'll talk about next is the Wilderness Act and stuff. When you're seeding in federal lands, is another one, and federal dollars. So I think seeding actually done like in federal lands would be one of it. Maybe there's more, you know, wilderness areas. So in North Dakota, you know, a lot of the areas that seed in those farmers and, but they do have the, don't think that the, correct me if I'm wrong, but the park out west, forget his. Yeah, Theodore Roosevelt. That within the project, I don't think that's within the operational project. I think that's a little bit. Well, it's right on the border, kind of. But I think it's east. It's more east. Somebody should look that up for me. typically, they are only done, I think, if you're going to put generators. A lot of ground generators, if you put them in wilderness areas, it's more of a permanent federal permanent requirement. You got to put them on state land and stuff. But I don't think there is any for North Dakota. And we could talk a little bit. Well, let's talk about and it goes back to the Wilderness Act here. That was, I got the nice picture here I found when they signed this in 1964. It has to do with, you know, kind of pristine that you haven't had a much of effect by man for these areas. So But typically the impact of like this act, wilderness act, is that it depends on the area, and then a lot of times it's just data correction. So, you know, it depends on the seeding area, if you're impacted that area where you want to put your seed generators. And I put the areas for North Dakota. I'm thinking that the park is a little bit outside here. So much. Oh. I need to look that up. Other questions? I always pause to see, keep you guys involved a little bit here. The other aspect is liability for legal. Do you have liability if you have a big storm and you're doing some crowd seeding? You know, do you have damage or liability impact to a plaintiff? And you know, you have a defendant that may be liable for some impact to a plaintiff. But one of the biggest things is the causation. So types of liability: trespass, negligence if you're careless, nuisance or dangerous activity. You can have economic, would be one of the big ones, income loss, expenses occur. But you can also have non-economic harm or impacts of operations. So give you an example of the Grand Forks flood, you know, so there could be liability in terms of, you know, carrying out some water modification access activity to increase precipitation. And this is one reason they don't seed when there's a lot of precip in the area, just to avoid that type of liability potentially being an issue. Additionally, I think there's a criteria a lot of times that you don't seed on traumatic storms that might produce or are producing tornadoes, because there's damage and there could be potential liability. So just to try to limit that, sometimes they make and do the operations and apply the technology to eliminate any possible litigation type of activities. Right, so if you're not seeding a storm that produces a flood, that limits your liability or potential liability. I love this one, causation. So if you have some liabilities from wet out, you have to prove then that your activity made this damage. So there's been cases where people try to prove the causality of a weather modification activity, but no one has won that. So the causation is the fact that, you know, does one cause the other? And it's causation, not correlation. So if you want to see a big correlation, there's a huge correlation between the amount of ice cream you have on different days that's consumed and the amount of sunburn that occurs on them days. Okay, so does that mean the ice cream causes the sunburn?
Yes, absolutely.
Absolutely, right? No. It's a big correlation. But does one cause the other? So they happen to occur on nice sunny days, right? People would like to have ice cream when it's sunny and not raining and cold. And then also the days you have sunburn. So I can find all kinds of nice correlations, but is it a causational effect? And that's very hard to prove legally. So you can have defenses against some of these. A lot of times the government has is immune from certain liabilities. So in some ways, having a regulation helps because it says, okay, the government's granted me this permit, they're immune from regulation to do that. The other defense, a lot of times you shift the cost, have insurance for different activities. So a lot of times on airplanes, right? We insure the airplane, we insure the flights, so that if something happens, you limit that stuff. And also you can have contracts that will limit what you're doing. You know, you're contracted to do something and you don't put in the amount. So if you go out and do all these activities and you do make rain and you do it without any issues, and you have some extra precip, who gets it? The theory would be the owner where the land falls or where the rain falls. First come, first serve is another way to do it. Some of the water rights in the Western United States are that way. The first use case, the first people to get to use it where they start using it. Sometimes it's historical, who starts to use this water, and if they continue to use it, they got the first use of that water. And then people that want to use it for something else, they haven't used it before, they're secondary. So you could say the people that paid for the seed-in would have it, the landowners, prior appropriations, landowners can appropriate and then you could just treat it just like natural precipitation. Okay, so, if you add a little bit of water to the natural precip, we're not going to divide up natural and artificial precipitation. So it's treated the same as the natural precipitation. And that's why I have the MD there.
For the people who seeded the storm were somehow able to prove that the precip came from them, would that mean that if they had first right to the water, they could charge for their farmers' use of it when it fell on their land?
It depends on the state regulation. So in North Dakota, no, because it's just treated as natural precip. And so then the water rights are the same as the natural precipitation that falls. Some places they do it to fill reservoirs, and people have hydropower. And usually the reservoir people don't really care. Idaho, there's power plants in Idaho. Where they pay for some. The easy way to do that is you just do the seeding that would be in your own area, right? If you only care about this particular property, this particular area, why would you seed anyplace else? So they don't really care for why they did that. Okay. That's the end of my first presentation for legal rights. Any questions?
So with the extra water and with that inquiry you mentioned last class period come out, do we know the actual impact that Lebanon has on the amount of rainfall that places get?
Okay. So wonderful question. You got to be a little bit more precise. And this is, I just had a discussion before this class with someone because we have science conferences and there's people that have presented some information about that. So do we know how much? I guess your question is, does it increase precipitation? So are you talking on one day?
Over a long period of time.
So over a long period of time would be over a season, right? So, or over several seasons.
Yeah, if you take a bunch of seasons and average it out, took the average season and the average rainfall, and then compare that to more average seasons with weather modeled rainfall.
So if you're gonna go over a long season, and a lot of times you tend to use models and you have to believe the models. And they did a big project in Wyoming, and they just reported on this again at the American Meteorological Society meeting this year. And so their number that they come up with over many seasons is on the order of 2% of snowfall. Actually, a little bit less than 2%. So that's a pretty small number, right? In terms of the percentage. Sometimes we hear 5 to 10%, but that's more on a per storm basis. And you can't seed and you can't affect all the storms. So that's what I was trying to explain, that if you go over a season, even if you increase it 5 or 6% or 10%, you're not doing that for all the storms for the whole season. So they come up with that type of number for a winter time or a graphic. And that doesn't seem like a big number, but if you want, you can convert that to acre feet, convert them acre feet to the amount of money that people pay for that. And then you do the economic impacts. And see the return on that. So that's the type of numbers they're talking now. And that's a lot different as it evolved. When they first came out with this, they had big ideas. Oh, we can do this 20-30% increases. But they had a lot of big uncertainties in that number. Now we get smaller numbers with less uncertainty. So does that kind of answer your question? I think I'll just go on to the next one here, but we take more questions, maybe a little break here. Take a few minutes rest. I can try to pull up another video. You guys want to see a video? Let's see. Take a little break with another video here. Let's see if I can pull this one up. Give us a little bit. So here's my P3 aircraft that I've been working with NASA. Let's see if this one works. So these are my aircraft that every morning we get together and talk about them. Oh, I can actually show you the video on your screen. Hold on a second. So I work with the NASA project. That's what I was doing before I came out here. So I'll show you a video of, this was the day that we first had to cross. And this was it coming back and landing on the first Tuesday of cross. So it's a P3 aircraft. And we're gonna try to fight a bunch of snowstorms. Get rid of the sound. Maybe you like the sound of engines running, right? Turn down the sound. So we're based at a NASA facility called Wallops. It's right on the coast of Virginia. They do a lot of rocket launches here. That's why they have it right on the coast, because they launch the rockets out over the ocean. And so that's its landing at night. Not too excited. Let me see if I can pull up and you can see the airplane. Go back here, and this is the So they just back in and
you can see it taxi in, and then we are there waiting to get on an airplane and see the instruments, get our data off, and then the scientists and people are on board. So I have some of my graduate students that are gonna fly this weekend. And the problem is we're studying winter snowstorms, and this airport has no de-icing capabilities and no snow plows. So a wonderful place to base your airplane and you're gonna study winter snowstorms, right? The idea though is hopefully it's on the coast, so a lot of it would be rain, but they have very long flight times. So the plan I think is to reposition the aircraft tomorrow to another airfield for the night and then fly back into the storm and then maybe come back and land there once it's the storm goes by. So it's a nice big airplane, four BOP engines on it, so you can kind of see. And then you can see the tail number. So if you're bored this weekend, go see if you find and watch it on Flight Aware or something, right? So that's one of the airplanes, and as you can see, we put instruments underneath the wings here. And as of right now, all my instruments are working on the airplane, so I'm happy. Right? It's like have a good airplane, have them work. So anyway, I'll just pause, turn that off. See the videos. So there's our little intersection here for the next 20-ish minutes. I get to the next port. Any questions? Did you find out about when the Packers and Broncos?
Yeah, it was January 25th, 1998.
That was the last time, right? Was that the only time? I think they did it twice, didn't they?
No, there's one more.
Okay. 98 it was?
Yes.
Okay, I knew it was in late 90s. That was when we had a certain quarterback that and a lot of receivers. So okay. Let me see on the next one. So that was legal aspects. And I guess I'm recording at my office, so I should have the recording, but I guess I didn't forget to record it to the crowd too. I need a checklist to get all these things I need to do for each one of these. So the next part is environmental and social issues. So the previous one was legal issues that went on. This one is environmental and social issues. Get the right one. So environmental impacts, what's, if you do any activities, you wanna make sure, and people are interested in making sure that you don't have long-term significant negative impacts on the environment. I said some states require environmental impact studies to undertake any changes in the environment. So one of the more concrete
impact assessments of what a modification was done by the Bureau of Reclamations for Project Skywater in 1977. So historically, the Bureau of Reclamations, they're the ones that do a lot of the dams out west, and they're concerned about water. So they would be the one of the federal funding agencies that would fund, and they funded a lot of research and applied applications of weather modifications in the 1970s and 1980s. So they haven't done much funding recently. So they went and looked at a number of possible effects and drafted a document about the environmental impacts. And one of the things, of course, we use silver iodine. And if you really care, I got a picture of it here. It's a yellow type of substance. I got a big, nice bag of it in my lab. So it's a powder, tends to be insoluble in water. So this is silver iodine. It's a compound. So a lot of people, you got to be careful when you talk between silver and silver iodine. So silver iodine is a compound that's bonded together. Elemental silver is very different and can have a lot different effects in the water. Because it's insoluble, it's difficult to get it into the water and into the food chain and absorbed into river material. The other thing is that the silver iodine, the particles that nucleate the ice are about 25, 30 nanometers in size. So a nanometer is 10 to the minus 9 meters. So they're very small. An order of magnitude less than the wavelength of light. So because you just need a very small one of these to get the particles started, you don't need a whole lot of mass. Therefore, you're not putting a whole lot of this material into the environment. You know, you don't need big amounts of this to be released. So a small amount, so typically environmental effects go by the amount of material that would be affecting the environment. You can have effects on vegetation and animals. So, you can look at the difference of, you have additional moisture, additional precip affecting the natural vegetation. So you can have some modest increases. You know, if we're talking 2% over a season out west, it's kind of a trade-off, right? People say, well, if you're going to actually do this and it has a big effect, well, then you're going to be changing the natural precipitation, which you could have huge effects on the precipitation. So there's kind of a trade-offs that as we realize that, you know, the seasonal impacts are not necessarily that big, then that would even reduce the environmental impacts of stuff like adding precipitation. Relatively small in terms of the precipitation. So I said 2%, on an annual average. How much do you think in the Western United States, if you looked at the same basins that I take that 2%, from one year to the next, how much do you think the precipitation fluctuates? I'll give you a choice. I love my orders of magnitude. Is it closer to 1% that you have the precip fluctuate from one year, 10%, 100%, or 1,000%? So, okay, how many people say 1%? And how many people say 10% it fluctuates? Okay, how much? 100%. No. How about 1,000? Okay. Well, this is interesting.
The fluctuations is between 100 and 1,000%. It's huge. You know, the natural variation from season to season is huge. So one year you can have twice as much precip as next year. That's not unusual. Okay. So when you have these huge variations, that's why I say, you know, you've got to think of this in terms of relative magnitudes. And this is one reason why it's so difficult to assess. Right? If every year you're getting hundreds of percentage changes and you're looking for a 10 or a 5% change, you know, it's a small number on a big variable. I'll show you some of the North Dakota stuff when we see that. So these numbers have to mean something in terms of this 2% change. So maybe it doesn't matter because next year when you have the drought, you're gonna have half the, you know, the precip, and you increase it by a little bit. Does that make sense? So effects on precipitation were probably more apparent than effects on animals. But again, changes in vegetation can affect the animals. So it's really not a noticeable one that they, you know, effect that they could see in terms of plants and animals. The other concern would be to look at erosion effects. Different erosion, you could have more runoff. But again, when you have differences of hundreds of percentages of runoff, and then you got a couple, you know, 1 to 10% changes, it's again pretty small. But you can have some erosions, you can add to that, particularly if you have some existing conditions. Another adverse effect that's not just erosions, you know, you can think about some people will benefit and some people will not benefit, right? Because a lot of activities, you know, you could increase the amount of snowfall, and you could think of, well, that's beneficial to people that want the water, maybe like the snow, right? If you have some activities that benefit from more snow, like skiing or something, or snowmobiling or some activity, but you could also have some people that would want less precip. If you got to remove that snow, right? It gives you more work if you got to plow and remove the parking areas. Loggers that want to get in and remove the trees, some activities, recreational stuff, is it a benefit or a hindrance? It depends on your activity, right? So, you know, some people may benefit and some people may not. And that's why it's a pretty localized endeavor. You can't say that one activity, one application would be beneficial to everywhere, every place. So, sociological issues, you know, usually are discussed in debates, disputes, you know, discussion in public forums, particularly if there are wild concerns on this. Issues can then blossom into problems if you, you know, can have arguments, controversies, and lead to fear on stuff. So a lot of times we discuss that. So that's one of the things that scientists do. You know, we're not just writing papers. The idea is that we have public presentations, conferences that are more general for this. And I've participated in a couple, even in South Korea. And they're very interested in air quality, air pollution type of things also. So And then you think about this, that the public is, you know, like I said, it's not just one group of people. You can have different concerns and different types of people with different ideologies that would have different perceptions. So a lot of the things can be driven by some types of misinformation, right? If you don't know how much the natural variability of precipitation is, or you might think it's very small, you know, that would be an example of some misinformation. Or if you think that you're seeing it and causing floods, that you cause this particular storm when you didn't know if you seeded there. Some people have emotions and fears. And then the other thing is not everybody is the same in terms of public interest debates. Sometimes you have very influential groups or people for that. So, so fear is one of them of weather modification. You know, fear of some economic negative impacts, life-threatening floods, tornadoes. Maybe you have the fear that other people will benefit from the work, but not you. You know, impacts, the derivatives, and irresponsible environmental impacts or irreversible, I guess I have here. And then other stuff that we just, you know, this comment or fear that we shouldn't be doing anything that affects the atmosphere, nature, and stuff like that. So these are fears that people have. And if you do them, you might have some negative impacts. So basis of fears, a lot of times there are misconceptions, which is sometimes the easiest to address, about how the atmosphere works, the toxicity of AGI, and possible effects. So I think I have enough time here. I found this with a cartoon here. This guy, I don't know if you've ever seen someone in an airplane like this. You know, they're kind of crutching their hands. You know, I like this. He has one of them. I would put, you know, he kind of got his hands crushed, his eyes closed. So I'll tell you what a story. When I was flying crowd seating in West Africa, we would work with the local meteorologist, local scientist there. So I was kind of in the back. We ran out instruments, take data, try to understand the conditions that they were seeding. And so typically we had a 340 aircraft that we would fly a Cessna, and there would be a pilot, co-pilot. Jody Fisher was the pilot, Chris Carr was a co-pilot for the summer that I flew it. And I would be in back with my weather computer, taking the data, watching everything, seeing what type of liquid water we had in the clouds. And so I had another scientist come with me, and preface this with a couple of words of background. West Africa, Mali, is an area that used to be colonized or originally colonized a lot by the French. So there's a big French influence. So French is a second language. Not too many people speak English, like in some places, it's more like a third language. So in a way, and I speak very little French. So my colleague, while he could understand English, he couldn't speak it very well. Okay, so he wouldn't say too much. So we went up and he's kind of sitting across from me and I'm on the other side looking at this guy. And we went out, we did some top seating, punched through a couple of crowds. You go into the crowds, you
you release your prayers. And a lot of times you get the, you hit the initial updrafts in the crowds and then you get back out of it. So you get this, what a bump when you go in and come out of the crowds. And we did a couple passes. And he wrote a note to me in very good English. Passes mean a note. And the note says, Dr. Devine, I think that was very underlying, severe turbulence. Okay. And I'm like, so I go to him, oh, not too bad. That was, you know, kind of normal. So he kind of got used to that. We went up to the north. We did some soft seating for 2 or 3 hours and kind of nice isolated style, great study. And he kind of got used to that. Well, then we're getting low on gas and out of seating material. So we have to head back. And anyway, there was a big line of thunderstorms that formed between where we were and the airport. So now you're kind of thinking, okay, what are we gonna do, right? So it was a pretty long line. We could probably go around it. We had enough fuel, we could go around it. So, but we have a radar operator that has a radar, you can see the storms. And the radar operator said, hey, there's some holes in this line. I never found out what happened, but he said, yeah, I'll give you vectors so you can vector through one of the holes between the cells, right? No problem. Well, the vector did not put us through the hole. It put us through the middle of one of these big 45, 50 dBc thunderstorms. Okay, now we're not in the turbulence for like 10 seconds. We're in the turbulence for 10 minutes. Okay, 15 minutes, we're coming in for the landing, bouncing around. And, you know, we have things just rain on the floor and you hit the bounce, it flies off. And, you know, things are not quite like on this nice commercial airplane. But I look over at the guy, he's like this. He's got his hands on the floor, his eyes closed, his teeth clenched. I'm like, what do I say to the guy, you know? Well, you know, I was just like, okay, I don't know. But the co-pilot, Chris, he's kind of a jokester. So he comes on the radio with our headsets and in a very, very serious voice. I can't do it, but he goes, are you scared? I'm scared. This is terrible. I've never seen it so bad. And I know he's joking, right? But the guy doesn't. He understands this. This is so I'm like, and of course, if I just contradicted him or something, it would just make him feel worse, right? So he was scared, really, really scared. And he came home with me. We drove back to the city and he talked to my driver all the way back in French. And I couldn't understand it, but it was like, oh. I asked the driver, what was he saying? Oh, he's paranoid. He thought he was going to die. He thought he was never going to see the ground again. So guess what he said the next day when I asked him, you want to go flying again today? He said, I'm kind of feeling sick. So anyway, so I sympathize with this guy and seeing that other person. He did go flying a couple weeks later and got over his fears. So there's uncertainty a lot of times in fears. How well does it work? What might be done with this technology, you know, particularly possible military applications. And then a lot of this stuff is very based on very early optimism. People are very optimistic about what could be done. And so they tended to have a inflated sense of what was possible. A lot of concerns are based on mistrust of government because this is regulated, you know, all these people actually protecting us. Who, quote, owns the atmosphere? You know, it's a shared resource. So is the water. Like I said, you know, there's some ideas of potential military
applications. Who's liable? You know, I want to make sure I can have some impacts of if there's negative stuff. How stringent and should there be stringent regulation? And then also, you know, the need, you know, do you have to have rigorous proof or preponderance of the evidence? You know, a lot of times in medical trials, you have a pretty rigorous proof of some medications. That type of high level medical type of proof is not available for weather modification, okay? You know, sometimes we, you know, statements of effects are based on preponderance of the evidence. Evaluation is very important, and transparency and information are critical. So a lot of times when you do these projects, you want to be very transparent and provide information. Because that, if you don't provide information and not transparent, that just leads to mistrust issues and other stuff. So what's the general public opinion? You know, a lot of times public is confused about it. You know, can we simulate and understand the research and operations? And then, like I said before, the need is not uniform. There's a bigger need out west than there is in the east. And evaluations are critical. That's one of the things I like and I do is evaluate projects. So about one third of people are opposed for just perceptions of religious and natural beliefs. Like, you know, we shouldn't be doing anything on a larger scale or regional scale that would affect things. A lot of people are lukewarm to it. They don't really have a strong opinion one way or another. And then a lot of times it's all perceptions of what people have to begin with. So evaluation, weather modification, I said it's difficult because the small changes compared to natural variability are not obvious. A lot of times people want to know if it's working. Because all they get in their money is worth. Is this worth spending my taxpayer money on, right? Why should we increase the water when we could be fixing the roads or something? Who does the evaluation is important, right? Even this, how you present the data. You know, you could take the same numbers and present it different ways, depending on your perception and your needs, I guess. And there's winners and losers, so that's the idea. These things come in terms of factors in designing a program. You want safeguards for any possible liability. You want to know about the economic impacts and benefits based on solid scientific evidence. Is it cost effective? Emergency conditions. And then some people may be benefited from that. Do you have compensation? And then the last thing I was in with right now is a lot of times public communication is key. So another picture of a presentation we did in South Korea with a bunch of people. So, okay, I'm only, I guess, 5 minutes late. So hopefully on Tuesday, I will start at 2 o'clock and then I won't be 5 minutes late. So do your assignment and I hope to have another assignment for you on Tuesday and some more questions.
Yeah.